smile on your face. Don't bring everybody.
That's true. Hi guys, we're all members of the senior class committee and we wanted to make an announcement for the seniors about a reminder for tonight.
Let's see, is there any 06 in the building? All right, 06, as you know, we'll have a dinner in Annenberg tonight and then, yeah, Annenberg. Yo, and then at 10 o'clock, we're all gonna go to the liquor store, which is actually a club. I know it's a little bit weird, but you take the Boylston T-Stop, and first 250 people in attendance will get a free drink ticket. There will be a bull riding contest. And as you notice, there's like a stoplight theme. There's no green on stage, but a lot of people will be wearing green later. So just come on through, it's gonna be fun. Tall Mike make an appearance.
Hi, good morning. Morning, good morning. Seniors, be quiet, please. Thank you. Still have a month left. So, one of the main conversations that I have during office hours on email is the issue of how do we make effective, lasting change. Because as we talked about in the change lectures, you know, it's easy to experience a high, you know, a sense that yes, I'm going to make a difference, but then very quickly to go back to our base level. There's a lot of research that suggests that most of us go back to our base level of well-being, of self-esteem, of happiness. So the question, you know, the million-dollar question in the ultimate currency is how do we attain, how do we enjoy lasting change? Today's lecture is very much about that. There are very few interventions that actually work. Mindfulness meditation does. We know from the Cambridge Somerville study, a 5-year intervention didn't work. We know that very often people experience a spike in their happiness levels, up or down, very quickly to go back to their base level. Most interventions don't work. Mindfulness meditation does. And today what I will do is I will talk about the art as well as the science of this ancient practice. An ancient practice in the East, relatively new in our part of the world. Last week we talked about perfectionism, and I said to you that this was the most important realization for me in terms of attaining higher levels of personal well-being, moving from the perfectionist extreme more and more toward the pursuing excellence side of the spectrum, shifting the pendulum. But understanding this was a cognitive realization, a conceptual one, realizing that I was a perfectionist or tended toward perfectionism. In terms of behavioral change, the practice that actually had the most difference, that made the most difference in my life was when I took up mindfulness meditation. It's a practice. Why is it so effective? Because it focuses on the ABC of change: effective, behavioral, and cognitive. And it works on all three simultaneously. And this is how it is able to overcome, or we're able to overcome, by practicing it, the flood of change, or the flood of habit, rather, that prevents change. And habits are difficult to change. Remember, we first make our habits, and then our habits make us. And therefore, we need a strong intervention. Mindfulness meditation is just that. Let's look a little bit, very briefly, at the history of meditation and how it came to our part of the world. Again, in the East, in India, China, Tibet, meditation has been practiced for thousands of years. In the West as well, but it was mostly restricted to the monastery, to the temple, to the mosque. It was very rare that you saw meditation practice en masse, as it was for thousands of years in the East. The people who brought this practice to the West, I guess the two people that can be credited most with it, are Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who brought transcendental meditation, and Shirunyu Suzuki, who wrote the book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. These two practitioners popularized to a great extent this practice. But initially when they came here, it was in the 50s, 60s, you know, it was considered being part of the hippie movement, you know, unscientific. Some people considered it voodoo art, mysticism. Didn't really catch the interest of the scientific community until the 1970s, because one can't argue with results. You see, one of the things that meditation practitioners promised, coming from the East, promising to Westerners, is calm and equanimity. And very often, they delivered. Many people were able to transform their lives in a meaningful, significant way as a result of starting to practice meditation, whether repeating a mantra, focusing on their breath, or praying with intention. Made a big difference, significant difference in people's lives, and science could no longer ignore it. And then a few scientists latched on and started to study this, initially being very skeptical, but very quickly being convinced of the efficacy of this practice. Two of them, Jon Kabat-Zinn, not far from here, UMass Worcester Medical School, a psychologist there, and we'll talk a lot about his work today. Another person, Tara Bennett-Goldman, who bridged East and West, who brought the practice of mindfulness and merged it with the practice of cognitive therapy. She studied both and then came up with a method for helping people overcome things like perfectionism, neuroses, anxiety, depression. Right here in the med school, Dr. Herbert Benson did a lot of research on what he calls the relaxation response. Again, taking these simple ideas and showing their far-reaching implications for a person's well-being. But what is meditation? Meditation literally means to familiarize ourselves. It's to familiarize ourselves with our breath, with our mind, with compassion, with other people, with an object, or with a thought. What's common to every meditative practice and what's common to every spiritual practice, every religion, is the one-pointedness, the focusing. It could be on a word, on a prayer, a passage, on a candle, on the breath, on another person, on the sounds. One-pointedness, the focus. This is the first thing that's common to all meditative practices. The second thing is, which is related to the first, is being in the here and now. Temporally and physically present. Shunryu Suzuki, author of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Zen is not some kind of excitement, but concentration on our usual everyday routine. There's nothing mystical about it. You know, people go into Zen and often think that they will find some, you know, some great mystical truth. That's it. That's what meditation is all about. Very simple practice. focusing on the here and now. Jon Kabat-Zinn, knowing what you're doing while you're doing it is the essence of mindfulness training. That's all. It means when you're breathing, you focus on your breathing. It means when you're talking to friends, you're focusing on talking to friends, being with them. When you're washing dishes, you're washing dishes. When you're attending a class, you're attending a class. It's being in the here and now. It is full acceptance of the present moment as it is. Tara Bennett Goleman, in a unique form of meditation, and a very important one, in this training of the mind, we learn to let go of the thoughts and feelings that pull us out of the present moment and to steady our awareness on our immediate experience. The essence of mindfulness meditation. What Tara Goleman Bennett is saying, that if we experience negative emotions, we experience negative emotions. If we experience joy, we experience joy. In other words, we give ourselves the permission to be human, to experience whatever experience we're having, without judging it, simply being. Now, what happens when conflicting thoughts come in? What meditators talk about is simply observing them. A disturbing thought comes in and we observe it, and they talk about clouds passing by, not fighting them, but just allowing the disturbing thought to pass and then to refocus on whatever we were focusing on, whether it's our emotion, whether it's the conversation, whether it's a candle that we're observing, whether it's a breath. Whenever there are disturbing emotions, not to fight them, to let them be, but rather to observe them, just passing by like clouds. Because remember from your readings last week about the ironic processing. If we say, do not think of a white bear, what we think about is a white bear. If we say to ourselves, do not think of the disturbing thought, whatever it may be, we think of the disturbing thought. Therefore, if we just let it be and return actively to whatever we were focusing on, this is the essence of mindfulness meditation. And the key here is that there is no such a thing as good meditation or bad meditation. It's not about some outcome, as most of the things that we do in our lives are. It's about the process. So even if in 5 minutes we have to return to the here and now 30 times because we have so many disturbing emotions, that's fine. We still gain the benefit of meditation. It's about the process, the present. And it's a true gift, because as I will argue in a moment, there are many, numerous benefits to this, and it's one of the primary generators of the ultimate currency, and it's all around us. It's right here, right now. It's not just a gift, it is a real psychological need to be present. We can't survive emotionally, psychologically. We cannot thrive psychologically if we're constantly living in the future. We talked a lot about the rat race, living for another point, for something else. Because it is a psychological need to be present, to be mindful, to be in the here and now, we pay a high price. It's not enough to say, well, 2 years from now, that's when I'll be mindful, that's when I'll be present. Until then, I will live for the future. It's not enough. It's like saying, 2 years from now, I'll eat. 2 years from now, I'll drink. Right now, I have no time to do it. It doesn't work that way. Just like we would die physically if we don't eat for 2 years, a part of our spiritual self dies. And unhappiness is when we frustrate an emotional need, which is what we're doing when we're not present. We're not experiencing the here and now. This doesn't mean not having goals. You know that goals are important. But it means that recognizing that the journey is the primary experience. And that's where we need to focus, the here and now. So if unhappiness is emotional starvation, how do we feed ourselves? How do we feed ourselves with the important emotion of being present? A lot of research has been done on it in the last few years. Let me share with you a project which I think is very significant, very important, which is reported on in a wonderful book by Daniel Goleman, the husband of Tara Bennett Goleman, in his book, Destructive Emotions. And what he talks about there is a meeting of minds, a meeting of minds between East and West. The chief participants, it was a small group of 12 scientists and meditators. The chief participant was the Dalai Lama. He was there for these days, and what this book does is recount the experience, the discussions, the conversations that they had during that meeting. Another person who was there was Richie Davidson, who's a graduate of the social psychology PhD here. And he does work on fMRI, using fMRI, PET scan, EEG. He's a neuroscientist. We talked about him a few weeks ago and we discussed neuroplasticity. We'll talk about him again later. And what they did was they met together and they talked about testing the ideas, the theories of the Tibetan meditation. And the Dalai Lama said, I want to put everything, this is his quote, everything under scrutiny. What doesn't work, even if it was there for thousands of years, we'll take out. Talk about non-attachment. Whatever doesn't work, we'll take out. I want everything up to scrutiny. And what they did, they brought in an experienced monk, someone who has been meditating for over 30 years, a European who found his home in Tibet and has been practicing meditation for hours, for three decades, hours each day. Another person who was there at the meeting, who also did a lot of research in this area, is Paul Ekman. Those of you who have taken social psychology may remember him from emotions, from the six universal emotions. He came up with this. He does a lot of work on lying and honesty. Probably the foremost researcher in this country on emotions. So this was the meeting of the minds and hearts. And it turned out to have remarkable consequences. Here are some of the things that they found after the meeting, because they launched a research program right after they met in India. So they took Lama Osser, an experienced meditator, and tested him on various parameters. First, they looked at the left-to-right ratio in the prefrontal cortex. Remember from a previous lecture? People who are happier generally have a higher left-to-right prefrontal cortex in terms of brain activity. More neural pathways on the left side of the prefrontal cortex than on the right side. The happier you are, the larger that ratio is. High correlation between the two. Also, left-to-right ratio predicts how quickly you will recover from difficulties. In other words, how resilient you are. This ratio also predicts your physical immune system, not just your psychological, emotional immune system. People recover quicker from disease when, as predicted by this ratio. So Lama Osser's ratio was measured. He was quite literally off the chart. This is him. This is the normal distribution. Off the chart. What this suggests is an extremely high levels of left-to-right ratio, which translates itself into higher levels of equanimity, overcoming difficulty, and well-being. But that's not all. He was tested in terms of how well he recognized super-quick facial signals. Super-quick facial signals. And he was able to recognize them better than anyone ever recorded. What this means are two things. First of all, this is associated with levels of empathy. More empathic, at least according to this measure, than any other person they've ever measured in their lab. They measured hundreds of people from all walks of life, from clinical psychologists to college students. And the second thing that it suggests, this ability to detect emotions, is also very fast mind, cognitively, extremely fast, faster than anyone else that they'd ever measured. So both in terms of emotion and cognitive functioning, superior to anyone else. There was another measure, this time taken by Paul Ekman, who has been studying the startle response in people for decades. What is the startle response? If suddenly there is a surprising sound, a loud bang, we shut our eyes for a millisecond. We blink, we startle. And it's something that's natural that they found in every single person, even in policemen and women. Now they practice their shooting constantly, all the time, but still every time that the gun goes off, they blink slightly, they startle slightly. Let's see some examples of the startle response in action.
I get no kick from champagne. Pure alcohol doesn't thrill me. So tell me why I should be cool.
Well, some things are more startling than others. Everyone has the startle response. Or so they thought. Until they measured Lama Osser, the first person in recorded history who can suppress the startle response. When he is meditating, when he's focusing, he is so relaxed, he is so calm, he is so focused on whatever he's meditating on, whether it's loving kindness or his breath, that nothing startles him. First time in recorded history. Now, the implications of this are huge. This is Daniel Goleman about it. Given that the larger someone startles, the more intensely that person tends to experience upsetting emotions, Osser's performance had tantalizing implications, suggesting a remarkable level of emotional equanimity. There is a correlation between anxiety and how easily we get startled. A responsive startle response also usually suggests higher levels of anxiety. But through meditation, he was able to overcome this response. Now, it doesn't just affect him as a meditator, as a practitioner. It also influences all those with whom he interacts. They did this experiment, and they had him sit down in conversation, in an argument with Western scientists. And he talked about controversial issues, such as why these scientists should give up science and become monks, and second, about reincarnation. Two controversial issues, especially when you talk to scientists. And he spoke to them, and they brought two people. Two people are reported on in this research. One, an easygoing scientist. And he had the conversation, great conversation, and the scientist and he were both calm. And then they brought another scientist, and they picked that scientist, especially because he was considered extremely contentious, very harsh, intolerant. They actually had a poll asking, who would you pick answering to these characteristics? And they had an argument about why that person should stop being a scientist and become a monk, and about reincarnation, which the scientists certainly didn't believe in. And this very controversial, very harsh, unforgiving scientist became calm while talking about these controversial issues. Here is what he had to say after the discussion. I couldn't be confrontational. I was always met with reason and smiles. It's overwhelming. I felt something like a shadow or an aura, and I couldn't be aggressive. As hard as he tried, he couldn't be aggressive. Now, people who have been in the presence of the likes of the Dalai Lama, Nelson Mandela, you know, people who have really, you know, Nelson Mandela unfortunately had many years to meditate, you know, 27 years in prison. So to reach such high levels of equanimity, it has an effect on everyone around them, and a positive effect as well. So this is mind-boggling. This is amazing. This is remarkable. Meditation really works, but there's a problem. Hands up those of you who have right now 30 years to spare to meditate. One, two, okay. Well, there are five, so there are another 850 who don't. 851. That's a problem. You see, I can't see myself now going off to the mountains of Tibet and meditating for 30 years and doing what Lama Osser did. It's wonderful, it's great, but it's just not for me. See, I tried it. I went to a meditation retreat. There are many of them around. There was actually one right up the road here at the Cambridge Insight Meditation. There are other 10-day retreats, which I said, you know, that may be a bit too much for me. But this was just a one-day retreat, 8 a.m. in the morning till 6 p.m. at night. And I said, this is just right for me. I'm going to go to it. I signed up, and I went. The presenter, one of the leading meditators in the world today, Larry Rosenberg, we came in. He seemed very relaxed, very calm. Immediately, I felt better. It was on a Saturday. We walked in, and he said, we're going to start with sitting meditation. We're going to do it for 45 minutes. I said, fine, great, I'm ready for this one-day retreat to be transformed. And I've been meditating, you know, I've been doing yoga for a long time. So I sat down, you know, with my legs crossed, back straight, and we started focusing on the breath. It was great. It was terrific. Now, after about 15 minutes, I started feeling a little bit edgy. Now, I usually meditate for 15 minutes. It's just right for me. So I started moving a little bit. You know, my back was uncomfortable. You know, straightened it up, and I was back at it. You know, happy and equanimous. Eyes closed. Once in a while, I peeked, you know, just to see if everyone else was with their eyes closed. But overall, I was doing well. Once in a while, there was a thought that came, but I knew that it was just a cloud. And I watched as the cloud passed and again went back to focusing on my breath. It was great. I was doing well. Then after a while, you know, I just had to sneak in a peek in my watch, and just under 30 minutes, I said, well, it's more than half. It's not that long to go. And I continued focusing on my breath, once in a while in the time, on other people, on the dishes that I would have to do that night. But overall, I was focusing on the here and now. And then the 45 minutes ended, and I felt great. I felt at peace. I said, this is the retreat for me. Larry Rosenberg spoke for a couple of minutes, and he said, now, would you all get up, please? And we all got up, stretch. And he said, now what we're going to do is walking meditation for another 45 minutes. I said, oh, shoot. Now, let me explain to you what the room looks like at Insight, at Cambridge Insight Meditation. So we were all sitting here. Larry Rosenberg was sitting in front. He had a couple of notes on the floor, and we were walking in a circle, one after the other, this way. And when you do walking meditation, you need to walk slowly and deliberately. Focus on every motion. Focus on your breath, but also focus on the leg coming up and then coming down. Just gradually, slowly walk. You're in no hurry. You ain't going anywhere. You're moving in circles. And we walked this way around the room. And we walked for about 5 minutes when clouds came. But I know how to meditate. I allowed the cloud to just move. And I went back to focusing on my walking. The problem was that after a short while, there were no clouds. There was a thunderstorm. More and more clouds came. But I went back to focus on my walking. And then I couldn't help it but look at his notes. It was interesting. I wanted to, I'm a teacher. I want to learn what he does. And what caught my eye was the schedule for the rest of the day. And I was walking, so I couldn't really look at it, but I saw something that I said, no, that can't be true. And I continued to walk. I was too far away. And I walked around again, very slowly, a little bit faster. You know, I took over the person in front of me because I had to get to that schedule ASAP. Now, again, the room, as I'm walking, okay, so he's sitting here. It's a beautiful room. You know, there are, you know, statues there. There is incense, you know, the beautiful smell, incense. And, you know, he's sitting here. I look at the notes again, and I said, no, that just can't be true. Because after walking meditation, there is 45 minutes of sitting meditation. And after, you know, I still look, after the sitting meditation, there is 45 minutes of walking meditation. I said, no, that just can't be true. And I continued to walk. Now even faster, even more desperately. And after that, I look, and this time, you know, I have a 4 in front of the other person because I've walked faster. I actually stop and I read it. And after the 4 sessions of walking and sitting, there is another walking and sitting. Then there is lunch. There is a break. Walking, sitting, walking, sitting, walking, sitting for 45 minutes a session. I said, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Tommy, I'm coming home. And I just walked out. I have not been back since. So that's after probably less than an hour. I don't think I would last 30 years of doing it day in and day out. Some people would, and it may be right for some people. For most people in our culture, it's probably not. Okay, so how does it help us? So how does it help us that Lama Osser did it for 30 years and attained these unbelievable results? Really mind-boggling results. How does it help us? In so many ways, because this is exactly what growing tip statistic is. Remember Maslow? Growing tip statistic is about identifying the best, the elite, the saints, the highly successful, the happiest, and learning from them and applying it to our lives. Whether we meditate for 10 minutes or we meditate for 10 hours a day. Here is what Lama Osser did, and it's not just because he's humble. He really means what he says. The process itself has some extraordinary qualities, but not necessarily the subject. The important idea is that this process is within the reach of anyone who applies himself or herself with enough determination, with enough persistence. How do we apply this? By meditating for 10 minutes a day. Meditation is basically practice, because then we can be mindful of everything that we do. Again, whether it's washing dishes or interacting with a friend, whether it's doing yoga or writing a paper, we're able to learn this quality of being present in the here and now. Daniel Goleman, in the book, from the perspective of neuroscience, the point of all this research has nothing to do with demonstrating that Osser or any other extraordinary person may be remarkable in him or herself, but rather to stretch the field's assumptions about human possibility. Tip of the stem statistics. Some of these key assumptions have already begun to expand, in part due to a revolution in neuroscience's supposition about the malleability of the brain itself. Do you remember until 1998, neuroscientists believed that our brain was a fixed entity. We couldn't change it beyond the very first years of our lives. It gave credence to a lot of Freud's ideas that basically we were predetermined by our genes and by our very early environment. But what they showed in 1998, and we discussed it when we discussed change, is that our brain changes, the neural pathways in our brain change until the day we die. We're able to change them constantly. The example of the taxi drivers in London who studied the map and their visual cortex actually increased in size. And we found the exact same thing in meditation. Neural pathways change. We can reinforce positive channels and weaken negative channels, i.e. channels that make us more predisposed to positive emotions rather than to negative ones, that make us take things less for granted in our lives, that make us more grateful, that make us more merit finders rather than fault finders. The person who's arguably more than anyone responsible, or along with a small group of people, responsible for bringing this idea, this fascinating idea, to the masses, the tip of the stem, to the general audience, is Jon Kabat-Zinn. Another person is Herbert Benson. Jon Kabat-Zinn specifically worked with Richie Davidson. And he did two things. The first thing that he did was he ran actual experiments, and he showed causation. In other words, the Lama Osser experiment could very well be correlate. I mean, it is correlational. We don't know what he was like 30 years ago. Maybe he's just off the charts through his genes. And he just happened to also be attracted to meditation. So what Jon Kabat-Zinn did was actually have an experimental design with a control group and an experimental group. The control group also signed up for a mindfulness meditation program, but they were on the waiting list, randomly picked to be on the waiting list, compared to a group that actually started the mindfulness meditation program. The program was 8 weeks long. They would meditate on average 45 minutes a day, plus they would have workshops teaching them, talking to them about meditation. They did a bit of yoga. They focused on their breath. They focused on their body parts, different types of meditation, which we'll talk about later. An 8-week program. So the second thing that Jon Kabat-Zinn did in his research was showed benefits to all. In other words, not just if you take 30 years off or 10 years off or even a year off. Within an 8-week program, possibly even less, you can attain significant changes. Let's look at some of the changes that he identified. Significant decrease in anxiety levels while doing the program, and it lasted after the program, compared to the control group, who was on a waiting list, waiting to be part of this program. Mood change, less negative moods, more positive moods during the program as well as after. There was a longitudinal study follow-up. The most interesting, quote-unquote, objective change, the left-to-right ratio in the prefrontal cortex actually changed significantly as a result of this 8-week intervention. Remember, until 1998, people thought it was impossible to change the way our brain works, the neural pathways. They thought they were fixed within 8 weeks, not even a full-time program. People who do these programs, and many people are doing it, it's being given right now as we speak at UMass Worcester. People who do it are working, so they meditate. They find 45 minutes a day to meditate. Herbert Benson showed that even less than 45 minutes a day can have a significant impact, as little as 10 to 15 minutes, as long as it's practiced regularly. It can decrease our levels of anxiety, increase our levels of happiness. This is an intervention that really works. What Jon Kabat-Zinn also did was inject the people with some cold bacteria. Why? Because he wanted to see how their immune system reacts. Those who were in the program, their immune system was stronger as a result of doing this. So not just emotional well-being, but also physical well-being as a result of meditation. Let's look at some other results. Benefits of meditation. There's a lot of research on it. One of your fellow students, Saviz Sepa, who did his sophomore tutorial with me 2 years ago, did research on self-esteem and meditation. And what he argued in his sophomore paper very convincingly was that meditation is a sort of a unifying theory of interventions. It brings together a lot of the other tools and techniques that are being used. And as I said earlier, it focuses on the ABC, affect, behavior, and cognition. He did his work on self-esteem, focusing on Nathaniel Brandon's work and on the 6 pillars. And what he did was show how meditation gets us to live more consciously, be more self-aware, be more accepting of ourselves, of our emotions, giving ourselves permission to be human, take more responsibility for our lives, be more self-concordant as a result of doing meditation, being more assertive. First of all, understanding what we are about and then realizing that understanding. More purposefully, people were more likely to achieve their goals. And finally, higher levels of integrity as a result of meditation. There's other research on transcendental meditation that shows the influence on self-esteem. So the control group, very little change, no change pre and post. People who were doing transcendental meditation, their self-concept actually strengthened. And there's a lot of research that shows the connection between self-concept clarity and well-being and self-esteem. Meditation in the workplace. Patricia Carrington, who taught at Princeton University, went into the workplace and taught the meditation. And what she found was that those who meditated, compared to a control group, absenteeism went down, turnover went down, creativity went up. Other research on transcendental meditation showed improved physical and mental functioning. For instance, less headaches, less backaches for those who meditated, as well as higher levels of happiness for these people. Also more productive and more likely to stay in the workplace. Higher levels of job satisfaction as a result of meditation. So you can even translate meditation to dollars and cents. That's why there is so much money being invested by NIH, for instance, now in the study of mindfulness meditation. Because if it makes people healthier, improves the quality of their lives, it can also be translated into dollars and cents beyond the ultimate currency, the currency of happiness. Intelligence. Those who meditate enjoy higher levels of creativity. Now, why that is, people don't know yet. It could be because people are in a better mood, and then, as Barbara Fredrickson argues, we're in a better mood, the broaden and build theory, and then we're also more creative. It also leads to higher levels of cognitive flexibility. This is very much associated not only with better thinking, with lack of rigidity, but also with overcoming perfectionism, which is very much about rigidity, the one single straight line, no deviations. Both short-term and long-term memory increases for people who meditate regularly. And again, when I say regularly, I don't mean 3 hours a day. 10 to 15 minutes a day very often is enough, as long as it's done consistently. People's reaction time. Remember Lama Osser, that his reaction time was the highest in terms of identifying facial signals? His was the best ever recorded. Well, people who meditate regularly enjoy an increase, an improvement in their actual reaction time. IQ. Most people think that IQ is a fixed, your intelligence quotient fixed from birth, genetics, maybe early experiences, not so. Adults who meditated regularly, after 2 years, they actually found an increase in their IQ levels. The control group did not increase. It works. It simply works. There is so much research now. I'm just giving you literally the tip of the iceberg of what's out there in terms of mindfulness meditation. Let me just discuss a few methods of meditating. There are many of them. The key issue, focus on the here and now, one-pointedness. These are the two key elements. Common one is just breathing. Deep breaths, inhalations, and slow, relaxed exhalations. This is very important today. Andrew Weil, if I had to limit my advice on healthier living to just one tip, it would be simply to learn how to breathe correctly. Andrew Weil, a graduate of the He's a medical doctor, a graduate of the medical school here, now running the integrative medicine program at the University of Arizona. Does serious research on quote-unquote alternative medicine. This is his single most important advice. Now, why is it so important? Because of the connection between mind and body. The connection between mind and body is that, for instance, if we're really stressed, if we have a lot on our minds, it actually affects our physical functioning. We start, our breath becomes more shallow. And when our breath becomes more shallow, it signals to our mind that we are in a fight or flight state. And then our breath becomes more shallow and become more anxious in a downward spiral. And that's why, remember the research by Cadison from here, 94% of college students countrywide, this is not peculiar to Harvard or to quote unquote highly competitive schools. Statewide, 94% of college students feel overwhelmed. And when we feel overwhelmed, it also influences our breathing. And we breathe more shallowly, and then we feel even more overwhelmed because of the connection between our attitudes and our behaviors, which is reciprocal. And when we take a minute to breathe, what we're doing is we're influencing our behavior. And our behavior changes, and therefore over time, our attitude changes as well. And we become less anxious, as Andrew Weil shows through his research. We become happier. Our blood pressure actually reduces with proper breathing. We become healthier. Our immune system strengthens. Now, the nice thing about this intervention is that we can do it anytime, any place. We can do it right now, and later we are going to do it. So for now, you don't need to breathe, but in about 20 minutes, we will. Breathing deeply. What's the right, quote-unquote, breath? Look at a baby. If you look at a baby, the stomach goes up and down, up and down. This is the healthy breathing, the deep abdominal breath, and that has very relaxing effects on us when practiced, and we can practice it at any moment. The only time when we shouldn't practice it is if we're hyperventilating, because that's when we have too much oxygen. That's why we take the brown bag and breathe into it, so we get more carbon dioxide. But other than that, when we feel anxious, we just want to take a time out during the day. A couple of breaths can do wonder. Again, the ultimate currency is right here. A mantra, this is what transcendental meditation focuses on, but a mantra doesn't just need to be a word that's given to you by someone else. It can be a word that you choose. It can be a word like relax. It can be a word like calm. It can be a word like God. Whatever word is meaningful to you. Herbert Benson, in his relaxation response, recommends that his meditators use the word one. Why does he do it? Because initially, he says, he got people to count. But he realized very quickly, and by the way, he was doing this research right here at the beginning, in the 70s. He realized that people couldn't really count for long. They would immediately be distracted. So he said, well, let me reduce it and let them count to 10. And then go back to one again. Harvard students, right? And then he realized that they couldn't really count to 10, that they would be distracted. So then he just changed it to one. And repeat the word one over and over and over again. And whenever there is a disturbing thought, just let it pass and return to the mantra, or return to the breath, or to the music and dance. One of the most significant generators of the ultimate currency of happiness. But it's not just, when I talk about music, for instance, I'm not talking just about music in the background. Because remember, the issue with meditation is the focus on the present. It's having the conceptual, the mind, focus on the sensual, whatever the sensual is. Again, a breath, a word, or the music. So it's not just having music in the background while you're writing a paper. It's really listening to the music, closing your eyes and allowing yourselves to, you know, to use the what has become by now the meditator's cliche, to be one with the music. I actually promised myself I wouldn't say it during this lecture. Sorry. So focus on the music or on the dance. We derive a lot from it. In fact, Maslow talked about music and dance as being the, along with sex, the number one generator of peak experiences. Maslow, it happens that music and rhythm and dancing are excellent ways of moving toward the discovering of identity. We're built in such a fashion that this kind of trigger, this kind of stimulation, tends to do all kinds of things to our autonomic nervous systems, endocrine glands, to our feelings, and to our emotions. It just does. And when he says it just does, it's because there is so little research on it. I mean, we don't know why that is. Maybe evolutionary or through God, we were rewarded for being focused on the here and now because people who focused on the present were more likely to survive, as opposed to being distracted, you know, when a lion is chasing you. I don't know why, but it just works that way. That's the way it is. Progressive muscle relaxation. This is a technique that was introduced in the 1930s, introduced to the West, has been done in the East for thousands of years, by Edmund Jacobs. And what Edmund Jacobs suggested is that we focus on one part of the body at a time. We tense it up. So let's say I'm focusing on my arm. I tense it up, and then I let go. And then I tense up my other arm for 5-6 seconds, and then just let it go and relax. And then work on body from tiptoe to the head, working on muscle groups, either individually, you know, we can even do it to, you know, a few fingers at a time, or to an entire arm at a time, depends how much time you have. So this can go on for 3 minutes or 30 minutes. Wide-reaching effects, this simple technique. Again, reduce levels of anxiety, higher levels of happiness and well-being. Why? Because it does two things. The first thing that it does is it gets us to focus on the here and now. And it gets us to focus on the here and now very often in a more effective way for the quote-unquote Western mind, for the ADD mind, because you're actually doing something. You're moving, you're thinking it, you're thinking about the muscle that's tensing up, and then you're letting go. So it focuses us on the here and now in a very effective way. The second thing that it does is, oh, no, these are the two things that it does. I just mentioned them. So again, it focuses us on the here and now. And second, oh, sorry, here is the second thing that it does. Now I forgot it again. It's amazing. Meditation improves short-term and long-term memory. The second thing that it does, it enables us to identify the difference between anxiety and relaxation. At least the physical manifestation of anxiety, because this is stress. This is relaxed. And when I'm able to differentiate between the anxiety and the relaxation, I have more control over it. So that, let's say I go to a meeting and I suddenly realize, whoops, I'm tensing up. I recognize this. This is familiar, meditation, familiarity. This is familiar to me. I'm going to breathe deeply and just relax my body. And the body influences the mind. It actually works. I've done it in interviews. I do it regularly before I speak to an audience, because right now I'm able to identify when my body is tense, and I'm already adept at relaxing it. And when I relax my body, my mind automatically changes as well, because behavior changes attitude. Using the five senses. You see, there are formal ways of meditating and informal ways of meditating. Meditating is simply about being present. So when you go for lunch in a short while and you focus on the way the food tastes, on the texture, you're meditating. When you're cleaning up your room, whether it's before Passover or before your parents come to visit, and you focus on doing it on the here and now, you're meditating, which is why we don't need to go on a retreat. Now, the advantage of going on a retreat is that you're practicing. You know, it's like going on and playing the game, but before that, you work out in the gym. That's what meditation is. It's a workout. I remember talking to one of my meditation teachers in Israel. It was right when I was starting it. And you know, I would go for lessons, and afterwards I would always ask him questions. And then I said to him, I don't have time to meditate. You know, I'm in such a hurry, you know, I was working hard then. I don't have time for this meditation. And he said, did you brush your teeth this morning? I said, of course. Why, is there a... I mean, yes, I did. Did you shower this morning? I said, yeah, I did. He said, do you do it every day? I said, yeah, every day. Do you have time for that? I said, yeah, because other, you know, this is, you know, it's hygienic. He said, so is meditation. Showering, brushing your teeth is physical hygiene. Meditation is mental hygiene. No different. And the consequences are sometimes similar. Physical hygiene leads to physical health. Mental hygiene leads to mental health. All it takes is, you know, my quote-unquote spiritual practice every day is I wake up in the morning and I meditate for a few minutes. I do yoga at least 3 times a week. I do gratefulness exercise every night. And now I've also started to read my gratefulnesses in the morning. So whatever I write at night, I read again in the morning. That's it. That's my mental, and just like I brush my teeth religiously, just like I shower religiously, I also do this religiously. It doesn't take long, but it's about the consistency. The experience of flow, when we're completely immersed in an activity for its own sake, when we read a book or write a paper and we're in the here and now, that's emotional sustenance. Csikszentmihalyi has found the consequences of flow in different areas of our lives. Self-esteem, motivation, happiness, resilience, overcoming difficulties, because it's just being present. And the nice thing about flow is that we can do it in any activity. And the last thing I want to talk about is yoga. Some people resonate to yoga, others don't. This is the single practice that has made the most difference in my life. It's a form of mindfulness meditation. In fact, now, some of you know, I'm working on getting my certification as a yoga instructor with Debbie Cohen. It made a huge difference in my life. So I want to talk a little bit more about it because many other people have derived similar benefits. And there's a lot of research on it. Once again, just the tip of the iceberg. Reduces stress and depression. More and more psychologists, therapists are actually using mindfulness meditation now, and yoga in particular. It increases self-acceptance and self-esteem. A lot of research in this area. Why? Because you're giving yourself the permission to be human, to be present. It's not about being competitive and being more flexible than the other person next to you. It's about being, the experience, the here and now. It helps overcome ADHD and asthma. It has even been shown to be effective with inmates in prison. Those who did yoga, relative to the control group, when they were released, they were less likely to be repeat offenders. That's remarkable. Just with yoga. The reason why I like yoga so much is for me, it's like multitasking, because it's also a workout for the mind and for the body in one. Also, it's very good for the same reason that PMR, progressive muscle relaxation, is so good. For an ADD mind that always focuses on different things, yoga really brings me back to the present, because some of the postures are not easy. I need to focus on them, as opposed to sitting and focusing on my breath, which for me personally is more difficult, or just walking around in a circle. Now, it reinforces our attitudes through persistent behavior. One of the things that you'll hear over and over again in a yoga class, focus on your breathing. Focus on your breathing. And what that does, it influences our attitude as well, and we actually become calmer. Let go of any stress that you're experiencing in your body. And what this does, it actually has an influence on how relaxed we are. When we do it, as well as after, relaxation levels increase as a result. But I do want to talk about a couple of caveats specifically with yoga and also meditation in general. It's not right for everyone. You know, try it, experience it, try different. I've been to many teachers. I've tried many mindfulness meditation techniques until I found what was working for me. Now, the caveat here with yoga is that not all teachers are the right teacher for you. Some people have gone to teachers and it hurt their back to do yoga with them, or it didn't make them feel good. They felt it was too competitive and too hard. Try out, and right here, you have people you can try with. So my teacher, Debbie Cohen, she teaches in the area. You can go to the MAC. They have classes there. They have classes, the UHS, second floor. Go there and you can sign up for classes in the, what is it called? The Center for Wellness and Health Communication, UHS, second floor. MAC, it's free. Also, very good teacher, Karma Yoga. Some of you may know him. His name is Jesse on Mass Ave. So there are many teachers around this area. Try it out. See what's right for you, what feels right. Go with your intuition. There's another caveat. Many people who start a mindfulness practice often detach themselves from the world. And what I would like to suggest is that the exact opposite needs to be the case. Meditation and yoga is about uniting. Yoga literally means to unite. It's about being present. It's about being with the other people as opposed to away. Because many people who would start yoga would get into it so much, or meditation would get into so much, that it's us who meditate versus them who don't. In group, out group, which we know about from psychology. So I would urge you to remain present, because what yoga can do is improve relationships with other people. It can make us more in touch with reality rather than detached. Let me show you an example now of someone who may be slightly detached. This is a home video on a vacation. Okay. Stay connected to reality. What I want to do now is spend 3 minutes meditating, if you will. If you don't feel comfortable doing it, by all means, actually don't leave now, because it will interrupt other people. We're only going to do it for 3 minutes. And I want to go through some of the things that we have discussed. So the first thing to do is when you sit down comfortably, both legs on the floor, firmly rooted, your back as straight as possible, your hands just comfortably on your knees, if you feel fine with that. You can close your eyes, but you don't have to. And focus on your breath. The breath coming in, the breath going out. And then focus on the breath as it comes into your lungs and all the way into your stomach. Belly breathing. Breathe in deeply and breathe out slowly, calmly, gradually. And then again, breathing in all the way to your belly. Breathing out slowly, gradually, calmly. One more breath, deep inhalation, deep, soft, slow exhalation. And move your attention to your right hand. Feel your right hand on your knees as you're breathing deeply. And now, not too hard, just clench your fist. Not too much force. And let go of your wrist. Relax it, your fist. Now shift your focus to your other arm. And once again, clench your fist. Feel your muscles there, be aware of them. And let go. Now shift your focus to your toes, to your heels. First, your right heel, your right toes. And just lightly, gently pull the muscles of your calf. And let go, relaxing it. It's even more relaxed now than it was before. Now shift to the other leg. Once again, the muscle of your calf. Pull it, feel it. Not too hard. And let go. Feel the same relaxation moving throughout your body, from the tip of your toes up to your knees, your leg muscles, all the way up your back, your stomach, your chest, your neck, relaxed. Every part of your body is calm. Shift the focus to your face. Relax your forehead, your mouth, your tongue, your cheeks and your chin. Experience the calm. Choose a word, any word. It could be God, it could be calm, it could be relax, it could be friendship. And very slowly, repeat it to yourself. Focus on the implications of this word for you. If your mind wanders, just return it to the word. Focus again on your breath. Belly breathing, deep, slow inhalation, slow, gradual, soft exhalation. And now gradually, softly, open your eyes. What I tried to do today was introduce you to the basics, a very superficial look, a very superficial look at the art and the science of meditation. Here is what, and I would like to end with the words of Tara Bennett Goleman, a person who, along with a few other psychologists, has bridged the East-West divide. The richest banquet, the most exotic travel, the most interesting, attractive lover, the finest home, all of these experiences can seem somehow unrewarding and empty if we don't really attend to them fully, if our minds are elsewhere, preoccupied with disturbing thoughts. By the same token, the simplest of life's pleasures, eating a piece of fresh baked bread, seeing a work of art, spending moments with a loved one, can be amply rich if we bring a full attention to them. The remedy to dissatisfaction is inside us, in our minds, not in groping for new and different outer sources of satisfaction. Enjoy your lunch today, enjoy your friends, enjoy the here and now.